And now, News Talk 1360 WCHL presents Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show about getting educated, getting hired, and getting inspired. Hosted by the staggeringly positive Kristen Heemstra, an experienced human resources manager and college admissions consultant. And now, here's Kristen on WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra, and you are listening to the Art of Potential show. We have a great show in store for you because we are going to be talking to Charles Salzberg about how to make it as a freelance writer. So, Charles, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and why you are an expert on this subject?
I'm an expert on very little, but I have been a writer for, 25, 30 years. So I guess I since that's what
that
I
counts.
Do, that's what I'm an expert on.
Yep. Okay, but you've written in many different types of venues.
Practically every type, because as a freelance writer, you have to be adept at many types. So I started off doing magazine journalism, and then that led to book reviews, and then that somehow led to ghostwriting books, and that led to writing my own nonfiction book, and all the time I was trying to write fiction at the same time.
You took a roundabout way to get there.
Right. And I also wrote plays and screenplays and just every dirty job in writing you can imagine except advertising.
And is that considered the dirtiest job or?
Well, for me it is because it's a very short kind of writing. It's writing to sell something. And I'm not really good at that.
Okay. Fair enough. So let's start at the beginning with the magazine writing. Would you say that if somebody is trying to make it as a freelance writer, and let me just let you know, like in the community we're situated in, we have experts on almost every topic there is. And then we have a lot of students and we have a lot of bloggers. So if somebody is trying to make a living as a freelance writer, what is the easiest place for them to get started?
Well, it's a lot different now, Kristen, than it was when I was doing it. But there are some similarities. And the best way to get started is to write, is to think of ideas and write. And don't worry about getting paid in the beginning.
Okay.
Even if you're writing for throwaway newspapers in the community or you're volunteering to write for book reviews or movie reviews for just little papers or whatever it is, what you want to do is you want to get in print. Or now the difference is that you can write for, the web has opened up things so much that you can write for places on the web like Huffington Post or whatever. And don't worry about getting paid in the beginning. What you want are what's called clips or samples of your work. And that will lead, if you're good, to paying jobs.
Okay, so it's almost like a gunshot approach. It sounds like you kind of have a barrage of things that you're sending out to as many people as you can possibly get to read them, would you say?
Yes, exactly. I mean, there are two kinds of writing in nonfiction. One are essays, and there are lots of outlets for that on the web. As I said, Huffington Post, or we have a web scene called ducks.org. ducts.org, but there are so many of them. My students find them all the time. The other things to do are nonfiction article ideas, and again, there are print, and there is on the web, and on the web, there are plenty of places, a parenting site. There are all these sites that are looking for, they're looking for content, or, you know, in your area, there must be newspapers or penny savers or whatever it is. And you just, the point of the realm is finding good ideas to pitch and to pitch them to the right place. And the other thing is, unless you know the markets, you're not going to really know how to pitch things and where to pitch things. So I would say go into your local bookstore or Barnes & Noble or whatever that has a big magazine rack and look at the magazines and whatever your interest is, they're going to be trade magazines. They're going to be specialty magazines. There's a magazine called Bark for dogs. but there's yoga magazines and whatever it is, you're going to find a magazine. And believe me, they need content and they love ideas. A lot of these magazines are fueled mostly by freelancers because they can't afford to keep a staff of writers.
Right.
And some of them might pay a penny a word. The best magazines pay anywhere from $1 to $3 a word. Another place to start is your own alumni magazine. Like I used to write for and still do occasionally, the Syracuse University magazine, and they pay pretty well. So if you come up with ideas that have to do with the university or the area or someone profiling someone who's who's graduated from the school and has some fame, it's really just using your ingenuity to find the topic and then find the audience for that topic.
And that's a great way to look at it. So when you are a freelance writer or trying to make additional income or get your writing in print, what you're really doing is trying to create opportunities for yourself to be published. So it's not necessarily picking the topic you're most familiar with as much as coming up with something that other people want to read.
Exactly. I mean, I was rarely familiar with the topic before I either pitched it or got an assignment from a place. You know, I can't tell you how many things I learned about before actually writing the article, but having to do it to get the assignment. You know, you have to have a really good sense of curiosity. And like any other business, it is a business. And like any other business, you have to know who your audience is. So even if you're opening up a store, you have to know who your audience is for that store, who's going to come in and buy stuff. And then you have to figure out how to reach them. And in terms of freelance writing, the way to figure out how to reach them is what magazine or what website caters to the kind of people who want to read the article that I have in mind.
So when you talk about a pitch, do you write the article first and then send it in and say, look what I'm delivering to you on?
No. As someone, you know, your time is kind of valuable, and you learn as a freelancer, never write anything without an assignment, except in the really, really early part of your career. And even then, do the research enough to write the query letter. And there's a difference between that and essays. With essays, you actually have to write the whole essay because they have no idea how it's going to come out. But in terms of magazine articles, you have to, I would just research enough to write the query letter or the pitch letter.
Okay, so what should you include then in your pitch letter?
Okay, the pitch letter is really kind of simple in a way. What you want to do is, you want to start off with what you think would be the first paragraph or the first few sentences of the article itself to give them a sense of your style and how you would open up. That's called the lead of the article. After that paragraph, the next paragraph essentially is just telling them exactly what you want to do in the article. And the third paragraph is how you're going to do it, who you're going to interview, what you're going to do to get the information. And the fourth is really just a little about yourself, your bio, why you're the right person to write this pitch. And they usually shouldn't be more than about a page or a page and a half.
Okay. And when you pitch someone, do you also include previous work that you've done?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And now what a lot of writers do because of the web is they just include the link to where they're where their work is. But if you don't, if you're querying actual magazines, almost all querying now is done, from what I understand, by email anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually the best way to do it, is to include the link. Some magazines might want you to do it to mail it in, and then you would definitely, if you have clips, use them and send them in.
Include a hard copy of those.
And you know something, if I were just starting and I had no samples of my work, I would write something. And even if it wasn't published, I would send it in to show what your work is like.
That's great advice. And I have also seen, just to go to a different venue, I've seen job seekers do that as well, just to show the quality of what you're capable of. And it just really does, to your point, give the person receiving it a sense of who you are and what you're capable of doing. That is great advice. All right, you are listening to the Art of Potential show. This is Kristen Heemstra. I am talking with Charles Salzberg, and we're talking about how to become a freelance writer. We will be right back.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. I am talking with Charles Salzberg. We are talking about how to make it as a freelance writer. And Charles, can you tell us some of the magazines you've written for?
Sure. My first articles were published in New York Magazine. And then I published in Esquire and GQ. And then I moved on to, because I thought it would be easier, and it's not, I moved on to Celebrity Profiles, because I thought they paid more money and they were easier. They did pay more money, but they weren't easier. So I had to deal with celebrities and PR people. And for those, I did cover stories for Red Book Magazine and for Ladies' Film Journal and for McCall's. And so I've written for almost any. I also wrote for the New York Times, Arts and Leisure, and the book review section, and practically every major magazine, I'd say, except for the New Yorker, which is really tough to get into.
So just an off-the-beat question, but who is your most fun celebrity to interview and profile?
The hardest? Well, the hardest were the ones, and I had a facility to do them. The toughest were the ones that didn't want to be interviewed. Many of them just did it because it was in their contract to do the publicity. So I'd say the toughest were people like Kevin Kline and Amanda Plummer and Lonnie Anderson and Meg Ryan. Those were the toughest because they did it only because they had to, because they were promoting something.
Right, and those are personalities I often think of as being, you know, fairly easy to know and open, but it doesn't sound like that was your experience at all.
No, the best interviews, Kristen, I would say, are the ones that have no inner censor in terms of what they will say. And the best interview I think I ever had was a woman, a comedian named Brett Butler, was from down south,
yep.
Georgia.
I remember
and
her.
She would just, if you asked her a question, she would just answer it. It didn't it didn't matter what the question was. She would just answer it. I can give you examples of that, because I remember them this day if you want. But she was terrific.
Well, I would like to hear an example of what that was like.
Okay, well, it was for Red Book Magazine. And at the time, Brett Butler had gotten breast implants. Okay. And so the magazine, the editors wanted me to ask her if she was ever worried about the effects, the after effects, the medical effects of having breast implants.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like, there's certain questions I didn't like asking, and that was one that was really personal. But the editors really wanted me to ask it. So I thought, well, I'm going to just blame the editors. This is a tip for any of you people who have to ask embarrassing questions and don't want to. Blame it on the editor.
Right.
Say the editors want to know. So I asked her, I said, Brett, you know, the editors want to know, did you ever worry about the health implications of having breast implants? Now, this is a woman who was an alcoholic. She had been shot at by her husband. She had been in a near-fatal car crash. She was a drug addict. At one time, and she had just gone through all this stuff. So I asked her the question. I said, Brett, did you ever worry about the medical implications of having breast implants? And she said, honey, wouldn't it be ironic after all that's happened to me if my tits killed me? So, I mean, that's gold for a writer. And a lot of times, there's no way someone would say that, especially if they had a PR person there monitoring everything they said, which she did. She didn't need one.
It would have killed her career, it sounds like. That would not have been in her best interest.
Yeah. Well, the other answer she gave me, again, was totally uncensored. You know, when I asked the question, and she said, recently I was on the Barbara Walters show, and she asked me about my breast implants, and I thought, honey, I'm not the only one in this room with stitches.
Yes, again, probably something her PR person would have advised against.
Yes, exactly.
You ever
want. And I printed them. The magazine printed them, and there was no problem because I had a tape of her saying it, and she wouldn't have denied saying it anyway.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay, so you have done, obviously, celebrity profiles for magazines. You also did a book or two, didn't you, with some high celebrity people or high profile people?
I did books, yeah. I ghostwrote a couple of books with celebrities. I did a book with the comedian Soupy Sales, mm-hmm. who, by the way, was from the North Carolina area.
Okay.
And I did a book with Joy Behar, who's on The View.
Yeah.
And, I have done a few books, but also with sports figures who were kind of celebrities as well.
Well, so it seems to me you were able to carry over your magazine writing into books, and they probably went back and read your magazine writing and decided you would be a good person to then do the whole book or ghostwrite the book. Is that how that unfolded, or is that?
Pretty much. I was doing magazine art. Actually, the first job I ever got ghostwriting was a friend of mine called me up, and she said, I've just been asked to ghostwrite a book for a famous men's clothing designer, but I got a job as an editor and I can't do it. Would you be interested? And I had never done anything like that before, but you know, as a freelancer, you never turn down work.
Right,
the biggest bit of advice I would give to anyone who wants to be a freelance writer is never say no. Never say I don't know about it or I can't do it. Do it. Just say you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and interviewed with him, and sure enough, I was shocked. I mean, I was wearing jeans and a T-shirt. He was dressed in a three-piece suit. But for some reason, he liked me, and I did it. And that was the first book I ghost wrote. And I figured if I could do a book on how to dress, I could do anything. And the other stuff started to come to me. What will happen to your listeners is that once they get a reputation of being a good writer and being on time and being reliable, it'll take a while, but they'll build up a body of work, and people will trust them with things, and work will start to come to them. It won't be fast. You have to be really patient, but if you follow those things, it will happen for you. But it's good to have a trust fund or a spouse that works, or a very cheap rent. I had the last of those. I had a really cheap rent.
So what I'm hearing you saying is don't quit your day job to become a freelance writer.
Right. I'm saying if you have another job, keep it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have it, it's not something, no one ever goes into writing to make money. This came up the other day, and I was on a panel, and one of the writers said, and it's true, you will probably make more money, at least in the beginning, working at McDonald's than you will as a writer. You have to love to do it and want to do it and be in it for the long haul. But I will say it is an incredible life because, first of all, you don't have to go out in bad weather. You don't have to get dressed up. And you can learn about incredible things that you never would have learned about. And anything you're curious about, you can try to pitch and get an assignment and someone will pay you to research it. And it's just, you will meet very interesting people as well.
Would you say that as you write, your writing has improved?
Writing to a group?
Would you say that as you have gone down this career path, has your writing itself changed?
Yes.
Okay.
My writing has gotten better, and I never would have thought that would happen. Not that I thought I was the greatest writer ever, but I never thought that doing journalism would make me a better writer, but it was, in effect, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in terms of writing fiction, which is what I always wanted to do. And now I just do write fiction. And it was, part of it was because I needed word counts when I was doing magazine articles to get word counts. And they'll say, we'll give you 1,200 words, or we'll give you 500 words, or we'll give you 1,500 words. And you have to stick to that word count. And what that means is you have to make every word count. Mm. And that is a great thing for a writer, because if you're writing fiction, no one's over there telling you how many words you have. And so that was one of the big lessons I learned as a journalist. And the other was how to interview people and how to research. And so for my Swan book that's coming out in October, it takes place in the book world, the world of rare books.
Okay,
and so I found someone who does that, and I interviewed them. And I just used my skills as a magazine writer doing that.
Okay, I want to hear more about this. We actually need to take a quick break because I think there's a lot of important information here. You are listening to the Art of Potential show. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Charles Sainsbury.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I'm talking with Charles Sainsbury. When we just stopped, Charles, you were talking about how you were using your journalism skills to do interviews for your fiction book, correct? Can you tell us a little bit about what it means to walk in as a journalist, and what kind of questions are you looking to ask? What do you need to know?
Well, that depends on the article, because almost every article has a focus, and the editors usually tell you what the focus is, and so you go in and you try to elicit that information. But what you're looking for as a magazine writer is you want stories, you want anecdotes. You don't just want facts. Those are easy. You want people to tell you about things and to give you stories. So earlier I spoke about the Brett Butler situation.
Mm-hmm.
So if she just said to me, no, I never worried about the health implications of having breast implants, that's a pretty boring quote.
Right.
But if she gives you a story that has to do with it, you're in good shape. The other thing that the other tip that I would give is that any kind of interview, for no matter what, is kind of like a blind date. And it's a mutual seduction, because you're trying to get information from the person you're interviewing, and they're trying to control the interview so that only information that they want out that makes them look good is given. So the best way to do it, I think, is make it a conversation, is what I used to do. And I don't think there's any right way or wrong way to do this, is I would write down areas that I wanted to cover. I wouldn't write down specific questions necessarily. I would do areas. And then I would think of it as a conversation, getting to know the person. And in that way, elicit information. And it also makes it more comfortable for them, because it's not so easy being interviewed, and it's not so easy interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
You're both going to be nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to put the person at ease. And often what does that is, if you know something about the subject or the person and you connect with them early, they're going to like you. And if they like you, they're going to be more apt to give you information.
Okay, so I want to go back to like a Meg Ryan or a Kevin Kline, which you found to be a difficult interview. How do you work through those? Because I do think every freelance writer is going to come across somebody who doesn't want to be interviewed or is doing it because they have to. How do you bring that out then and make it some type of value-driven piece?
Well, I can tell you exactly how I did it with Kevin Kline. I remember is I read about him, and I read an interview that he did, I believe, for Rolling Stone. And I could tell in the interview he didn't like the interviewer, that it was a really tough interview for him. And the other thing that I knew that was important was that he was very good friends with Amanda Plummer, who I had interviewed previously. So going in, I think the first thing I said to him was, I read your interview in Rolling Stone. You didn't really like that interview or the situation, did you? And he said that he opened up right away, and because I was able to bond with him, he told me about it. And mm-hmm. he also liked the fact that I had interviewed Amanda and that she had liked the interview that I did with her. So that really helped me in terms of bonding.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like even when you're doing celebrity interviews, it's not so different than everything else, where if you come in recommended by someone else, you're going to get a better audience, you're going to get listened to, you're going to have a more immediate opportunity to bond with someone if you've been referred in by another party.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the situation with interviews is that if you're not too aggressive, if you're nice and available. People love to talk. People used to ask me, is it hard to get people to talk on a subject? And I would say that it's hard to get them to shut up. Because think about your own life. How many people actually listen to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, your husband, your wife, your kids, your friends, rarely anyone. But here's someone not only listening to you and asking you questions, but they're writing down the answers or they're taping it and they're making eye contact with you. And so it's a very seductive kind of thing. And I would get people to tell me things that that I was shocked they were telling me these things because sometimes they were very personal. And it was only because they started to feel here was someone who was interested in them and was wanted to hear what they had to say.
In a lot of, like, my background's in counseling, and a lot of what you're talking about is something that we would tell upcoming counselors to do. It's the undivided attention. It's the focus on somebody else and repeating back what they say so you can make sure you have it clear. It really does provide a forum for people to open up. Do you have any anecdotes off the top of your head of what people said that surprised you?
Anecdotes about that.
Yeah.
I do have one. When I first started, I was given an assignment to do a piece on people who ripped off inventors. And what they would do is they would put an ad in the paper and they'd say, if you have an invention, we will help you market it and patent it and advertise it. And they would take a lot of money from these people. And so I went to someone's home who was an inventor and who had been ripped off by one of these very people. And it was a shabby apartment in Queens with a hole in the wall. And unfortunately, the people's son had just it was around 4th of July, and he had firecrackers in his hand, and they'd gone off and blown off a finger of his hand. It was a really sad situation. And so here I was coming into their home and talking to them about the situation, and they'd lost a lot of money by being ripped off. And so I sat down, and we did the interview, and the husband asked me if I needed a ride to the train. And I said, sure. And so we got in his car and we're in the car and he says to me, this has been very hard on me. I've lost the services of my wife. And I thought, oh, please God, let him be talking about like cooking and cleaning.
Right.
And no, he went on about the sexual part of their marriage, how it had been affected. And I thought, oh my God, you know, he didn't tell me not to put this in the article, but it's really great stuff. And he's going to be so embarrassed later if I put this in. And I didn't put it in. But I remember learning that after a while, people do let their hair down and they start to think of you not as a journalist, but as a shrink or a friend or a priest or a rabbi. and so I realized how much power you can have. And I also realized that you see this all the time where someone will say, oh, I never said that. Mm-hmm. And then the journalist will present the tape, and sure enough, they did say it. They just are so mortified that they could have said it that they really right. believe they didn't say it.
Right. And that, and to your point, there's also like an ethical line you're walking where this person, you know, to your point, he didn't think that you would include something like that in the article, which is probably why he shared it with you. Even though
right. There's always an ethical line, and some people cross it, and I never did because it's just the kind of person I am. I just right. didn't think it was worth it, and I would put myself in their place and right. realize that if it happened to me, I wouldn't be very happy.
No, you wouldn't be very happy, and you might have been the first person to hear this guy's story. And, you know, he's looking at you as a confidant, like you were saying, as a priest, like someone, finally somebody can come here and help me and help my situation. And then if you turn around and kind of expose them, it's just one more piece of evidence that the world is terrible.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that exactly what happened is he probably never said that to anyone,
mm-hmm.
ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it made him feel better saying it.
Right. And it got out, and now he's, yeah, I can see that. This is the Art of Potential show. This has been this is an interview with Charles Salzberg. Charles, where can people, do you have a website people can go to learn more about you?
I have a website, charlessalzberg.com, and it's really easy for anyone these days, unfortunately, because they can just Google my name, and and I have students come in who probably know more about me than I do.
And this, of course, will be on the artofpotential.com's website, so you can go there.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Charles Salzberg. Now, Charles, you have written for magazines. You've written a screenplay, and you have written, how many nonfiction books have you wrote?
Over 25. I've sort of wow. lost count.
Wow. Okay.
I know that sounds strange, but I really have.
No, I believe it. You have so much to say. I mean, who can keep track of all that?
Oh, I have very little to say, Kristen, but that doesn't stop me from writing.
Okay, but your most recent, or I guess your favorite venue, then, is fiction. Can you tell us a little bit about your fiction writing?
Actually, this is kind of an interesting story, and I hope that it's inspirational to writers. Is about 25 years ago, I wrote a detective novel. But it was kind of an anti-detective novel because the ending was that the detective doesn't solve the crime, that it was totally random. And I shopped it around, and every editor said, we really like this book, but we can't have an ending where the detective doesn't solve the crime.
There's no closure.
So, I'm sorry. So I put it away in my drawer, and then 20 years later, I found it, read it, thought this is pretty good, and I updated it a little, and I sent it around. And an editor said, really like this, but you have to change the ending. And so what I learned over those 20 years was to sell out. And so I did. So I changed the ending, and they published it. It's called Swan's Last Song. And it was nominated for Seamus Award for Best First PI novel, private eye novel. And I lost, and I got really angry that I lost, and I had no intention of writing a sequel, but I did, just so I could try to win an award, because I lost that one. And this one is coming out in October. It's called Swan Dives In, and it's kind of unique. Once again, I sort of played with the genre, because no one gets killed in the book. There's no murder to be solved. And you don't know what the crime is until about two-thirds of the way through the book.
Oh, wow.
And then by the end of the book, you're not even sure there is a crime. And so I actually did, you know, I do have a publisher for that, and that'll be in October. And I'm working on a third one now. And if someone wants to read something right now with a Swan story in it, there's a book called Long Island Noir, which just came out, and there's a Henry Swan story in that, called A Star Burns Bright. Then I have another novel coming out next July, not this July. It's called Devil in the Hole. And it's not a Swan novel, but it's based on a true crime of a man who killed his entire family and disappeared.
Wow. Okay, so I want to go back to your fiction. You were talking about The Swan's Last Song. You had a book. You had an ending. You learned that no editor approved of the ending. So when you're talking about editors, it sounds like you shopped it directly to a bunch of publishing houses. Is that how that happened?
Well, the first time I did it, I have an agent. But after writing all these books and making friends with editors, sometimes I find that it's just easier to give it right to an editor.
Right.
And in that case, I had worked on a true crime book with an editor and owner of a publishing company called M. Evans, which did a lot of books. It was a very large independent book company, publisher. And so I went straight to him and showed it to him. I still had an agent do the deal. And then what happened, and this is what happens in publishing sometimes, the book was in galleys. I knew exactly what it was going to look like and a cover. This happens about 5 months before the book is published. And it was all set to go, and the owner of the company died.
Ooh.
And his wife decided to sell the company. And she sold it to a company that didn't do fiction. And so they gave me back the rights. They didn't ask for the money back, but they gave me back the rights. And my agent had to find another publisher for it. And he did.
Oh, good.
So that happened, but it wasn't very pleasant.
Now, in one of your areas of expertise, Charles, is on publishing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you're considered one of New York's greatest teachers?
I don't know. I didn't pay anyone off. That happened accidentally. Well, like anything else, Kristen, I'm sure what you do as well, if you do it long enough, you start to understand how it works. And you start to make friends in the industry, and you hear stories, and you have students who publish. And one of my students was Lauren Weisberger, who wrote The Devil Wears Prada. Mm-hmm. And so you get together with them and with other writers and editors, and you swap stories, and you start to learn how an industry works. So I'm a good listener, and I really like hearing these stories, and I sort of remember them and try to apply them to whatever help I can give to anyone. So that's pretty much the way I pick up information, and probably everyone does.
So you're teaching now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you're teaching and what you're teaching?
I'm teaching advanced nonfiction, but often a novelist, a budding novelist, will, or sometimes someone who's done books already, will sort of sneak into the class. And that's pretty much because they've heard about Lauren and another student of mine, Sally Coslow, who wrote a novel in my class, actually wrote three of them. And right now, I used to teach at Syracuse University in the journalism school, and I taught at Sarah Lawrence. But right now I'm teaching at the Writer's Voice and the New York Writers Workshop, where I'm one of the founding members.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all here in New York City.
So tell us, like, if a person has a book that they've worked on, fiction or nonfiction, what would the New York Writers Workshop do for them? How would that help them?
Well, it would give them great feedback about what they've written. Often writers work in a vacuum, and it's good for them to be able to share their work. I have, if someone in my class has really good piece of work, I will suggest an agent for them or introduce them to an editor. But mostly it's about working with your peers and not feeling so isolated as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have access to classes, which many people don't, although in your area there's so many schools,
right.
I would start a writer's group.
Mm-hmm.
And get a bunch of writers who are going to be honest with each other in terms of sharing their work and critiquing their work, and just meet every week or every 2 weeks and you know, share 15 pages of your work every time.
So as a writer goes through this and they are getting their craft more and more, I don't know how I want to say this, but they're getting better at their craft and they feel like they have something that might be of value to others. Do you recommend that they go through an agent? And if so, how would they find one?
Yes, I do. I think that you should always have an agent. It's too tough to do it yourself. And what you do is either, if you know writers, I would ask them to make suggestions. If you don't know writers, then you can go to something on the web called agentquery.com. And it's really good because what you do is you find your genre. It's the drop-down menu. And you click on it, and it will give you all the editors, I mean agents, who do that kind of genre. And it's really important to find agents that do your kind of work. There's nothing that turns agents off more than someone sending them a YA novel, a young adult novel, when they don't do that kind of work. So it's really important to do that. The other thing is to find out some of the big agencies and go to their website. And under all their agents, the agents will tell you what they're looking for and whether they're open to submission. So those are the three ways that I would do it.
That's great advice. And can you query the same agents at one agency, or do you go individual agent by agent? Like, I'm trying to think if you approached an agency with 20 agents.
Generally speaking, one agent per agency.
Okay. So that you don't embarrass yourself and everyone talking about you at the water cooler. All right. Well, this has been the Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra and my guest, Charles Salzberg. Charles, thank you very much for joining us. And there will be links to his work on the Art of Potential website.
Thank you, Kristen.
1360 WCHL wants to connect with you online for updates on our lifestyle programs, awesome giveaways, contests, trivia, community photos, breaking news, and more. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/Chapelboro and become our fan on Facebook by visiting facebook.com/1360WCHL. And always connect with us online at chapelboro.com.